content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading this week from the April 29th, 2016 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. A victorious Trump attacks a crooked system. What happened? Donald Trump swept to an emphatic victory in the New York primary this week as he stepped up attacks on the GOP's primary process as crooked and rigged, and shook up his campaign team to better handle a possible convention battle. The billionaire businessman took 60% of the vote in his home state. He won at least 89 of the 95 delegates available, while Ohio Governor John Kasich picked up 4. Senator Ted Cruz, Trump's nearest rival for the nomination, who has repeatedly denounced the billionaire's New York values, came away with nothing. Cruz, like Kasich, can no longer mathematically win a majority of pledged delegates. Both candidates are hoping to deny Trump a majority and then win at a contested convention, where most delegates will be free to vote for any candidate after the first ballot. With 1,237 delegates needed to win and 625 still to be allocated, Trump has 845, Cruz 559, and Kasich 148, with 2 delegates yet to be allocated in New York. Trump spent much of the past week complaining about the primary process, especially after Cruz won all 14 of the available delegates at a state convention in Wyoming on Saturday. The frontrunner, who has brought in several experienced political operatives to help his campaign, railed against Cruz for getting his supporters appointed as delegates in many states. He also warned of problems if he's denied the nomination at the July convention in Cleveland. "I hope it doesn't involve violence," he said. "I'm not suggesting that, but I will say this. It's a rigged system. It's a crooked system. It's 100% corrupt." What the editorial said. Despite the scale of Trump's romp in New York, the result doesn't significantly alter the trajectory of the Republican race, said USA Today. The reality TV star always had to do well in his home state to keep alive his hopes of reaching 1,237 delegates, and he still faces a narrow path. To clinch the deal, he needs to win a substantial majority of delegates in the 5 Atlantic states voting next week: Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Connecticut, and Rhode Island, and then pull off a string of impressive victories in Indiana, Nebraska, and California. For a man who claims he wants to unite the Republican Party, Trump keeps acting as if he's mounting a hostile takeover, said the Wall Street Journal. The party's delegate rules are the same for everyone. Trump and his campaign were simply too lazy or inept to learn them. What's more, the frontrunner has arguably benefited more than other candidates from the convoluted delegate allocation system. Going into New York, he had won 45% of the delegates with only 37% of the vote, and got an even more lopsided windfall in his home state. "Trump is right to say the process is undemocratic," said Los Angeles Times. "So what? Primaries and caucuses aren't designed as exercises in direct democracy. They're designed to help the party pick a nominee with broad-based support and the best chance of winning a general election. And if delegates weren't allowed to switch horses after the first round or two of balloting at the convention, the possible stalemate between Trump and Cruz would never be broken." What the columnist said. "Trump is preparing to be a sore loser," said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. "All his whining about the delegate system is a dress rehearsal for the convention, should he come up short and be denied the nomination. Trump now realizes he's come up against a far superior campaign. Cruz's success with delegates isn't a nefarious establishment plot. It's a testament to his impressive ability to connect with and organize the party's activists. Even if Trump doesn't win a majority, don't assume he's done for, said Andrew Prokop in Vox.com. In all likelihood, the billionaire will enter the convention in Cleveland with more delegates, states, and votes than any other candidate. The delegates won't be making their decisions in a vacuum. They'll be under huge pressure to reflect the will of the people. The whispers within the party are that Trump doesn't even need to reach 1237 before the convention, said Eli Stokols in Politico.com. About 200 delegates will arrive in Cleveland as free agents. If the frontrunner ends up 50 or even 100 short, he'll probably be able to persuade enough of those unbound delegates to carry him over the line. Either way, Trump finally appears to be thinking strategically, said Doyle McManus in the Los Angeles Times. Since he demoted his pugnacious campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, and hired experienced campaign professionals Paul Manafort and Rick Wiley, he has stopped giving nonstop television interviews, started courting GOP power brokers, and planned a series of scripted policy speeches. He has also released $20 million to his team for campaigning in May, vastly more than in any previous month. All this has prompted speculation that Trump is already pivoting for the general, said Isaac Chotiner in LateSlate.com. But for him to convince the electorate that he is presidential, he'd have to change his brash, arrogant personality. Don't count on it. And a second main story. Clinton regains aura of inevitability. What happened? Hillary Clinton recaptured the momentum in the Democratic presidential race this week with a resounding New York primary victory over Senator Bernie Sanders, setting up potentially decisive clashes in a string of Atlantic states next week. Clinton won 58% of the vote in her home state to 42% for her Brooklyn-born rival. While Sanders swept upstate counties and won 67% of voters under 30, she crushed him in New York City and its suburbs and overall captured 75% of the African-American vote, 64% of Latinos, and 61% of women. The result followed a run of Sanders' victories and weeks of acrimonious campaigning in which the Vermont senator hammered Clinton for giving lucrative speeches to Wall Street firms and questioned her presidential qualifications. The race for the Democratic nomination is in the home stretch, Clinton told supporters. Victory is in sight. Sanders remained defiantly optimistically headed into next week's primaries in Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Delaware, and Maryland. We think we have a path toward victory, he said. Clinton now has 1,428 pledged delegates to Sanders' 1,151, with 2,383 required for the nomination. Add in superdelegates, party leaders who can vote as they please regardless of their state's results, and her advantage grows to 1,930 to 1,189. To win, Clinton needs 28% of the remaining delegates, while Sanders requires 73%. To do that, said Chief Clinton strategist Joel Benenson, he's going to have to win massive landslides. What the editorial said, Sanders has no reason to give up his fight, said the New York Times. Yes, Clinton's lead is nearly insurmountable, but it should be voters who erase the nearly. Sanders has energized young voters and forced the party to confront issues like wealth inequality, college tuition costs, and the toll of globalization. Moreover, his reliance on small donors has shown the Democrats don't need to play the big money game. A welcome reminder for the party that first championed campaign finance reform. This leftward shift could put the Democrats' political future in peril, said the Chicago Tribune. to keep pace with her Democratic socialist challenger. Clinton has eschewed centrism and tried to sound like populist firebrand Elizabeth Warren on banking issues. She'll likely stick in the left lane in the run-up to November to keep Sanders supporters on side, but that could alienate moderates who voted for her husband and President Obama. What the columnist said. Fans of Sanders argue that he's the stronger general election candidate, but they're wrong, said Paul Waldman in TheWeek.com. Right now, he outpolls Clinton against Trump and Cruz, but that's because Republicans haven't attacked him yet. If Sanders were the nominee, the GOP would paint him as an American-hating Trotskyite who admires the Castros and wants to raise everyone's taxes, put the government in charge of everything, and cripple the military. By the time they're through with him, most Americans will think Sanders is too dangerously radical to run their local food co-op, let alone the U.S. government. Sanders' odds of winning the nomination are diminishing by the day, said Jeet Heer in NewRepublic.com. But he can still be the future of the Democratic Party if he plays his cards right. By further damaging Clinton, he risks being seen as a Ralph Nader-like spoiler. But if he works within the party, Sanders can use his considerable leverage as a power broker. He has mobilized the left, albeit with one Achilles heel, Southern blacks. If a subsequent candidate can better pitch his economic populism to that crucial electoral bloc, the future will belong to Sanders. Meanwhile, Democrats are left with Clinton in an unpopularity contest of unprecedented proportion, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. When she launched her campaign last April, polls showed Clinton's favorables slightly ahead of her negatives. But in a new Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, 56% of Americans view her unfavorably and only 32% favorably. Trump is even more disliked, Cruz not far behind, and Gallup data show all three are more unpopular than the losing presidential candidate at any point during the past five election cycles. That can't be a good omen for the presidency to come. Our controversy of the week, immigration. Is a Supreme Court headed for a 4-4 tie? The U.S. Supreme Court sounds more like Congress every day, said Jeffrey Tobin in NewYorker.com. Now evenly divided, 4-4 after the death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia, the court this week heard oral arguments in the case of United States versus Texas, which touches on two hot-button partisan issues, the fate of illegal immigrants and President Obama's executive authority. In 2014, President Obama signed two executive orders that spared from deportation some 4.3 million undocumented immigrants who are parents of children born in the U.S. The state of Texas, with the support of 25 other GOP-led states, sued to have the orders blocked. A federal court and a regional federal appeals court both upheld the suit. In the arguments in Washington, D.C. this week, the four Supreme Court justices appointed by Democrats predictably sided with Obama and the immigrant parents, while the Republican appointees, led by Chief Justice John Roberts, barely hid their contempt for the president. Many court watchers thought Roberts might again save the president's bacon, said Ed Kilgore in NYMag.com, as he did twice by siding with liberals on the Affordable Care Act. But Roberts scoffed at the government's claim that Texas lacks standing to bring the lawsuit, the easiest way for him to reinstate Obama's executive order. If the case is decided in a 4-4 tie, as now seems likely, the lower court's ruling will stand, and millions of parents and children will face a grim and uncertain future. This isn't really about immigration, said Ilya Shapiro in Reason.com. Whatever the merits of giving legal status to the immigrant parents of U.S. citizens, it's not for the president to make such legislative changes alone. Obama freely admits he signed these orders because Congress refused to pass a comprehensive immigration bill in 2013 that would fix our broken system. But frustration, however legitimate, doesn't give presidents the right to rewrite the law. Obama's lawlessness should trouble the court's liberal justices as much as the conservatives, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. How would they feel if the next president followed Obama's kingly example and chose not to enforce environmental protection laws or penalties for tax evasion? Immigration has always been a special case, said Brian Gorod in NewRepublic.com. Congress allocates only enough resources each year to deport a small fraction of the 12 million illegal immigrants in the country. For this reason, Congress and the courts have consistently and repeatedly given the president authority to decide which immigrants should be deported and which should be allowed to stay. Indeed, Republican Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush both signed orders protecting millions of immigrants from deportation. For some reason, it's only when Obama does it that we get lawsuits and cries of tyranny. To the right, says Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com, the action of Republican presidents are irrelevant, as are the legal arguments in this case. Everything Obama does is a case of psychotic presidential overreach by definition, because Obama. This case provides more evidence that with Senate Republicans refusing to let Obama fill Scalia's seat, the Supreme Court is struggling to function, said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. If the justices deadlock 4-4, the appeals court ruling stands, but only for the three states it covers, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. If that happens, liberal states like California may bring lawsuits of their own, leading to different immigration laws in different parts of the country. The result would be chaos. But when you let partisan politics utterly control a Supreme Court with a year-long vacancy, chaos is what you get. It was a good week for fuzzy math after a Gallup poll found that 57% of Americans think their federal income tax bills are too high, even though data show that just 55.5% of American households will pay any federal income taxes in 2016. It was a good week for crowdfunding after a high school senior in Lowell, Massachusetts, started panhandling at a local mall in a bid to raise money for college tuition. If people will give to the homeless panhandler, said Emily Strutz, 18, maybe they'll consider sparing a dollar or some change to an aspiring doctor. And it was a good week for Alexander Hamilton, who was saved from the Treasury Department plan to replace him on the $10 bill, thanks in part to the popularity he gained through the hip-hop Broadway show bearing his name. Hamilton won a Pulitzer for drama this week. But it was a bad week for Andrew Jackson, after Treasury decided instead to replace the former 19th century president, an enthusiastic slave owner who conducted brutal wars against Native Americans, on the $20 bill with African-American abolitionist Harriet Tubman. It was a bad week for napping on the job after a FedEx package handler fell asleep while loading up a flight from Memphis to Lubbock, Texas. He woke mid-flight and knocked on the startled pilot's cabin door. And it was a bad week for Johnny Depp and Amber Heard after the celebrity couple delivered a widely mocked court-ordered video apology for failing to declare their two pet dogs when traveling to Australia last year. When you disrespect Australian law, says a stone-faced Depp in a wooden acting performance, they will tell you firmly. On the briefing page, the Brexit vote. British voters will soon head to the polls to make a major political decision about their future and Europe's. What is Brexit? It's the issue of whether Britain should exit the European Union or not, a question that will be decided in a historic referendum on June 23rd. Polls show Brits split almost evenly between Remain and Leave camps, with more than 10% undecided. Passions are running so high that it has divided friends and families. Britain's most influential lawmakers and business leaders have broken into two warring sides, with Prime Minister David Cameron, who wants Britain to remain in the EU, facing a stinging rebellion within his own Conservative Party. Even the royal family has been dragged into the fray after a tabloid newspaper claimed Queen Elizabeth had privately expressed support for a Brexit. The royals denied that report. If Britain leaves, the ramifications for the entire European Union will be enormous, says Guillaume Closa, founder of the Europe Nova think tank. The recent Greek financial crisis, the Syrian refugee problem, and the terrorist attacks in Paris and Brussels have all combined to raise major doubts about the wisdom of a united Europe. So a Brexit vote could spark a domino effect, says Closa, jeopardizing the very survival of the European project. When did Britain join the EU? In 1973, though not without much hand-wringing beforehand. As an island that's always had a literal and psychic separation from the rest of Europe, Britain has been a largely unenthusiastic member of the EU. In fact, it has maintained a semi-detached relationship, refusing to sign on to the single euro currency or the Schengen Agreement on passport-free travel throughout the continent. Nonetheless, Eurosceptics from both the United Kingdom Independence Party and Cameron's Conservative Party argue that Britain is too enmeshed with the EU and has gradually ceded control of its laws, borders, and national sovereignty to a burgeoning bureaucracy in Brussels. After coming under great pressure from his own party's Eurosceptics during an election campaign last year, Cameron pledged to hold a decisive in-out referendum. What are the pros of a Brexit? Economically, Britain would immediately save $12 billion a year in EU budget payments. Freed from famously cumbersome EU regulations, Brexit supporters say Britain would attract greater investment and become a more dynamic economic hub, particularly if it still had full access to the EU's tariff-free single market. But that's a big if, and would rely on Britain renegotiating a new trade deal with the EU's remaining 27 member states, many of whom, post-Brexit, would want to make a bitter example of the UK and discourage other members from fleeing. What about immigration? This is one of the biggest issues for Eurosceptics. Since it didn't embrace fully open borders with Europe, Britain can already demand that visitors present a passport when entering the country. But under the EU's labor rules, any citizen of a member state has the right to live and work in another member state, a rule that has allowed some 942,000 Eastern Europeans to move to the UK as the EU has expanded its borders. Brexiters say these migrants have overwhelmed the housing system and abused Britain's generous in-work benefits. At least 34,000 of them are getting child benefits for children who do not even live in the UK, and sending that money, totaling about $42 million a year, back to their home countries. Leaving the EU would allow Britain more control over how many migrants are allowed to enter. That's become a big selling point after the influx of 1 million refugees into EU countries. What would happen if Britain left? A leave vote would trigger Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, starting a step-by-step two-year withdrawal process. Britain's parliament would have to repeal all the laws that bind the country to the EU and come up with new trading and travel agreements with the remaining 27 nations. That process would be a bloody nightmare, says Jonathan Portes, a former chief economist in the cabinet office. He warns that the uncertainty it would create could destabilize the markets and cause the pound to plummet. But pro-Brexit campaigner and political economist Ruth Lee says there's no reason to think that Britain, the world's fifth richest nation, couldn't quickly forge a new and positive alliance with the EU, though it would take maturity on both sides. What about the wider consequences? There could be many. Scotland, which sends half of its international exports to the EU, strongly favors the Remain side and has threatened to hold a snap referendum enabling it to break away from the UK if there is a Brexit. Without a seat at the EU table, Britain might find itself more isolated and its already diminished status as a world power weakened. The EU would lose its second-largest financial contributor and might find itself crumbling at the edges, particularly if other member states decide to follow Britain's lead. But given that no country has ever left the EU, it's impossible to say with any confidence what might happen. You could have a reasonably friendly divorce, says French economist Nicolas Vernon, or you could have a very acrimonious one. It's really uncharted territory. We'll read a few of the columns now. First from the U.S., accountants have nothing to fear. Almost everyone agrees that America's income tax is too complex, says Robert Samuelson. But despite some political rhetoric about simplifying it, the chances that the next president, whoever it is, will make major changes in the tax code are negligible. That's a shame because if we were to eliminate some costly, cumbersome tax deductions, we could cut the top personal rate from 43.4% to 30% and eliminate the preferential rate on capital gains and carried interest, and still raise as much revenue as we do now. The deductions that should go include the exclusion from taxable income of the value of employer-paid health insurance, which costs the government $211 billion a year, mortgage interest, $62 billion, state and local taxes, $84 billion, and charitable contributions, $54 billion. These loopholes mostly benefit the upper middle class and the wealthy, and getting rid of them while lowering tax rates would produce a system that's a vast improvement over the current one. Simpler, fairer, and more efficient. But all of these deductions have major constituencies, and neither Democrats nor Republicans have the courage to stand up to them. So accountants and tax lawyers' jobs are safe, and our tax code will remain hideously complex. From the United Kingdom, no phone calls, please. We're British. To encourage more foreign visitors, Sweden's Tourism Authority has unveiled a new hotline that connects international callers to random Swedes, said Rupert Myers. By all accounts, most of these callers ask benign things about IKEA, ABBA, and the Muppets' Swedish chef character. But if we Brits ever invited foreigners to call us and ask questions, it would be a thing of total, unmitigated horror, wouldn't it? We would be asked, for example, why we wear so much Lycra when we never exercise. Stroll into any fast food outlet and you'll find Brits dressed up in the latest sportswear, chomping down on burgers. People will want to know if we'll ever stop going on about the Second World War, our finest hour, which we invoke at sporting events and in just about every conversation about the European Union. We'd probably hear complaints about the British paparazzi and the British louts who go to Amsterdam or Prague for their bachelor parties. But surely the most baffling question is why the country that produced the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, and Adele sends a talentless musical act each year to the Eurovision Song Contest, where they're promptly bested by some over-emoting Eastern European diva. Do you love to lose? And an international column, Ecuador, surveying the wreckage after massive earthquake. Ecuador is reeling after its worst natural disaster in decades, said El Telegrafo in an editorial. The massive 7.8 magnitude earthquake that struck our nation's Pacific coast this week killed more than 400 people, injured thousands, buckled highways, and flattened countless buildings. The quake's epicenter was near the sleepy northern fishing town of Musne, but buildings collapsed as far away as Guayaquil, Ecuador's most populous city, some 300 miles to the south. Tens of thousands of people need immediate assistance, food, water, shelter. In the remote areas, power is out and the roads are impassable. President Rafael Correa cut short a trip to the Vatican to return to the country and assigned each affected province its own administration official to run rescue and recovery efforts. The military is coordinating the distribution of food, water, and medicine and building temporary shelters, and all bottled water companies have been ordered to turn over their stock. The president has toured quake-hit areas to assess the damage and witness the incredible outpouring of charity and volunteerism. The pain is very large, the tragedy is very large, Correa said. Still larger is the spirit of our people. After the first jolt, just about every Ecuadorian who wasn't injured leaped into action, said Rosalia Arteaga in El Tiempo. Churches, civic groups, and ordinary neighbors are doing all they can to extend a helping hand to those who are suffering. The tremendous response gives us faith in the future of the country, because its citizens show such deep empathy for the problems and pains of others. What is most touching, said La Hora, is that people of all ages and social sectors, poor, middle class, and wealthy people, are coming together. The quake hit coastal areas populated mostly by poor Afro-Ecuadorans, who are descendants of slaves brought here by Spanish colonists and who still face discrimination today, and by the country's huge refugee population, mostly Colombians fleeing paramilitary violence. But in this spontaneous, voluntary outburst of generosity, all of us are showing solidarity and love of country. Ecuador will need that spirit more than ever, said Hernan Perez Luz in El Universo. We are going to have to rely on ourselves because we can't depend on the government. Thousands of people will be displaced, probably for years, because entire villages need to be rebuilt or even relocated. Yet this tragedy comes amid an economic crisis of enormous dimensions in our oil-exporting nation. The precipitous drop in oil prices over the past 2 years, coupled with the economic mismanagement of Korea's left-wing government, already had Ecuador heading for recession before the quake hit. And we have practically no emergency currency reserves. Grave is facing Ecuadorian civil society. Our only consolation is that the spirit of solidarity we are demonstrating in the quake zone has always characterized the Ecuadorian heart. And on to the last word. Why Friends is still so popular. What explains millennials' obsession with a 1990 show about 20-somethings who hang out in a coffee shop? Asked journalist Adam Sternberg. It's nostalgia for a simpler time before social media. When the TV critic Andy Greenwald, who is 38, returned to his high school near Philadelphia last May to speak to students about his job, he wondered how it would go. After all, today's students are a digital generation who have only a vague association with the concept of TV. Sure enough, when Greenwald mentioned his job to them, one student in the group asked, "So what does that mean? Do you, like, watch Netflix?" Greenwald said, sure, he watches Netflix, since watching original streaming program on Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, wherever, is all part of covering the complex new television landscape. Then he asked teenagers if they watched Netflix. They said enthusiastically, yes. So he asked them what they like to watch on Netflix. They said enthusiastically, Friends. You remember Friends, right? Chandler, Monica, Joey, Phoebe, Rachel, Ross, and fleetingly, that monkey. Central Perk. We were on a break. The show that feels in its way as iconic a relic of the 1990s as Nirvana, Pulp Fiction, and a two-term Clinton presidency that The Onion later cheekily described as our long national nightmare of peace and prosperity. Friends was not only born of that era, but may, in hindsight, embody it more completely than any other TV show. Sexier than Cheers, less acerbic than Seinfeld, Friends existed at that sweet spot of populist mass entertainment and prescient pop escapism. If you were alive and sentient in the 1990s, you already understand this. In fact, if you were in or near your 20s back then and ever found yourself seated in a quirkily named coffee shop with a bunch of your own friends, you might have had the conversation, which friend are you? But while Friends inarguably excavated the zeitgeist, it was a very different geist in a very different zeit. For starters, the show's run from 1994 to 2004 corresponds almost exactly with that transformational decade when people went from signing up for this weird new thing called email to signing up for this weird new thing called Facebook. The world of Friends is notable to modern eyes for what it encompasses about being young and single and carefree in the city, but also for what it doesn't encompass. Social media, smartphones, student debt, the sexual politics of Tinder, moving back in with your parents as a matter of course, and a national mood that vacillates between anxiety and defeatism. Not to mention the absence of any primary characters on the show who aren't straight or white. Which is why you might expect that Friends, like similar cultural relics of that era, would be safely preserved in the cryogenic chamber of our collective nostalgia. And yet, astonishingly, the show is arguably as popular as it ever was. And it is popular with a cohort of young people who are only now discovering it, which is weird. I'm sitting on the couch, the actual couch. It's inside the actual Central Park Cafe set, which is now part of the Warner Brothers studio tour in Burbank, California. The couch, this familiar overstuffed orange sofa, is, for many people, the main attraction of the tour. Before our group set off in an elongated golf cart to patrol the studio's backlots, the guide asked if there were any Warner Brothers shows or movies that people were particularly interested in seeing. Friends, came the first quickest answer. Friends came the second. Another woman from the back called out, Friends, before someone finally said, Harry Potter. Later, I asked the guide if that was a typical reaction. I'm not going to lie, he said. Friends is definitely the biggest attraction. At stage 48, it's not unheard of for people to get engaged on the couch. A guide told me it happened just a few weeks ago. I asked him if any visitors, some of whom have traveled from across the world on a kind of pilgrimage, ever have unusual reactions when they finally sit on the couch. Oh, yes, he said. People cry all the time. It is, of course, slightly strange that a 20-year-old sitcom still retains such a magnetic appeal. For example, Warner Brothers also produced ER, which ran for 15 seasons. But there's no opportunity, nor likely much demand, to have your photo taken on the show's authentic gurney, let alone get engaged on it. Yet Friends' popularity seems to be on the rise. Between its various syndicated airings, the show still draws a weekly audience of 16 million in the U.S., a big enough viewership to make it a viable hit on current network TV. And that's not even including streaming. In the U.K., ratings for Friends repeats are growing, up more than 10% in 2015 from the previous year. And on January 1st, 2015, an entire run of Friends, all 236 episodes, or 88 hours worth, became available on Netflix. The company paid an undisclosed sum for the rights to stream it. The best industry guess put the price at roughly $118 million. One person who's noticed a resurgence in Friends mania is someone with some experience on the subject. Marta Kaufman, who was co-creator of the show with David Crane. It blows my mind, she said. Not only that people are still watching, but that people still connect to it. I have a 17-year-old daughter, and recently someone at her school asked, Hey, have you seen this new show called Friends? There are, of course, current shows about the modern lives of young urbanites, any of which would presumably be more relatable to young viewers. But for some, those shows, in all their circa 2016 grittiness, are a little too real. I watch shows like Girls, and it feels like the raw reality of life, said Kayla Yandoli, an intern at BuzzFeed who, along with her sister, a BuzzFeed staff writer, writes a lot of Friends posts. Friends is like the sitcom version of life. More than once, when asked about the appeal of the show, a 20-something quoted back to me an iconic line that Monica says to Rachel in the pilot, Welcome to the real world. It sucks. You're gonna love it. They explain that they've adopted the line as a kind of generational motto, which the line was intended to be, sort of, except for a different generation. No matter. The notion has an enduring appeal, especially given that for 20-somethings now, the real world seems suckier than ever. The 90s were a great time, says Chris Mustachio, who is 24, works in New York, and estimates he's seen every episode of Friends more than five times. Like more than a few people I talk to, he describes habitually falling asleep to the show. If you think about it, back then there was little conflict. It was pre-9/11. You could smoke on airplanes. You could smoke in restaurants. Bill Clinton was in the White House. He was the best president of all time. Post-9/11, the show became more popular, said Kaufman, and I think part of the reason is because it was optimistic. And certainly, with what's going on politically right now, this can feel like a darker time. I lived through Friends once. I was 23 years old when the show premiered, and I watched the Friends pilot under protest, prodded by my little sister. To my slacker-hardened sensibility, the show looked to be, at first glance, an anodyne attempt to chase the youth and cash in on the sour magic of Seinfeld. But I watched, and I laughed. and I kept watching. And eventually I had the conversation. I was Chandler. Now I'm in my 40s, and there is very little about the current world, especially culturally speaking, that reminds me of the world of Friends. When I was in college, people were still brandishing dog-eared copies of Neil Postman's anti-TV polemic, amusing ourselves to death. Now TV has shrugged off its consensus reputation as a purveyor of widespread idiocy to become the most celebrated artistic form of our time. I currently have a palm-sized computer in my pocket that's smarter than Deep Blue, the supercomputer that beat Garry Kasparov at chess in 1997, and on which, it turns out, I can stream Friends in its entirety. In 2016, we tweet, we text, we Vine, we swipe right. Friends, of course, reflects none of this. Mentions of the internet are limited to very occasional hijinks, like Chandler meeting a woman online who turns out to be his ex-girlfriend Janice. And I admit, I do find myself occasionally nostalgic for that moment right before the internet became all-encompassing, when you could only ever hang out with your friends in real life. And you never said IRL, because what other life would you be talking about, if not your real one? I feel nostalgic for the 90s in the exact way that every generation feels nostalgic for the era that coincides with its own youth. I'm not surprised or particularly apologetic to feel this way. I am, however, surprised that a whole new generation, all of whom are presumably much more tweet, text, Vine, and Tinder friendly than I am, is feeling the same way, and expressing it by embracing the very show my generation once embraced. After all, each generation has the right to bury the icons of its forebears, just as we in our Screaming Trees t-shirts once hated on the Eagles. Instead, these kids are going to Friends trivia nights at Asian fusion tapas bars and starting podcasts devoted to recapping and analyzing every single episode of the show. Part of the appeal is wish fulfillment, says Kaufman, of the show's continued appeal to younger viewers. And another part of it is because they're on social media all the time, so I believe they crave human contact. They crave intimacy and intimate relationships. They're looking at screens all the time. The world of Friends is recognizable, yet devoid of today's most ardent anxieties. On Friends, in their free time, they all get together in the coffee shop to chat and catch up, says Stephanie Pico, a 21-year-old fan of the show. Where nowadays we'll catch up really quickly, but everyone's always on their phones. Back then, it's more of a person-to-person relationship instead of through technology. In hindsight, that era seems idyllic by comparison, a fantasy life where friends gather on a sofa, not on WhatsApp. I asked Elizabeth Entenmann, a 27-year-old Friends fanatic, if you could make a version of Friends about the 20-somethings of today. No, she said, because you wouldn't find six people doing nothing in the same room. Or if they were, they'd all be on their phones, seeing what else is out there. On modern sitcoms like Netflix's Master of None or Love, the agony of the slowly answered or never answered text is a recurring plot device, so familiar and realistic that it makes us squirm along with the character on screen. There's no escapism to be had there. Instead, it reminds us of the sad modern paradox. Knowing you can reach out to anyone at any time hasn't actually brought us any closer together. And so the central pleasure of watching Friends, the feeling of being cosseted in a familiar place, free of worries, surrounded by friends, has never been quite so longed for as it is now. Paulina McGowan, 21, was born in 1994, the year Friends debuted. Watching it now, she says, it would be awesome to be alive back then when everything didn't seem so intense. It just seemed really fun. After the Warner Brothers tour, having hoisted myself up from the magical couch, I found it impossible while driving around L.A. to escape or ignore the pop hit Stressed Out by 21 Pilots. Current YouTube views, 152 million and counting. The song features the telling refrain, "Wish we could turn back time to the good old days when our mama sang us to sleep, but now we're stressed out." Eventually, we all grow up and move out of range of mama's voice, but I couldn't help think of all those young people who told me they now like to fall asleep to Friends. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Vulture.com. On the health and science page, why Earth's axis is moving. The melting of polar ice and the drying up of aquifers caused by climate change is altering how Earth turns on its axis, with the North Pole shifting a few millimeters eastward, a new NASA study reveals. The planet isn't perfectly round and tends to wobble as it spins at an angle of about 23.5 degrees. Geophysicists have long known that this process makes the poles drift slightly. The North Pole, for example, moved westward toward Canada's Hudson Bay for about a century. Then in 2000, it mysteriously reversed course, swinging eastward twice as fast as usual, reports National Geographic. Researchers previously attributed the shift to melting ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica. But updated computer models provide solid evidence that drought and the depletion of aquifers, particularly over the loss of water around India and the Caspian Sea, are also influencing Earth's distribution of mass and its axis. The recent shift from the 20th century direction is very dramatic, said NASA's Surendra Adhikari. The polar shift poses no danger, but researchers say it underscores the profound impact humans are having on the planet. The health scare of the week, more football brain injuries. The strongest evidence yet suggests that relentless blows sustained by professional football players can lead to serious brain injuries. In a new study, neurologists performed sensitive brain scans, known as diffusion tensor imaging, DTI, on 40 athletes who played in the NFL for 2 to 17 years. The players, who range from age 27 to 56, also completed thinking and memory tests. The researchers found that 43% of the athletes showed signs of traumatic brain injury, often a precursor of degenerative brain disorders such as chronic traumatic encephalopathy, CTE, and Alzheimer's disease. The cognitive tests revealed that nearly half the former players had problems with learning and memory, and more than 40% had issues with attention and concentration. This is one of the largest studies to date of living retired NFL players. Researcher Francis Conidi, director of the Florida Center for Headache and Sports Neuropathy, tells LiveScience.com, and one of the first to demonstrate significant objective evidence for traumatic brain injury. And we'll move right into one of the Talking Points articles. Saudi Arabia, was it complicit in 9/11? As President Obama visits Saudi Arabia this week, his hosts are still dodging an uncomfortable question, said Mark Mazzetti in the New York Times. Did wealthy Saudis and perhaps even officials of the Saudi government provide critical support for the 9/11 attacks? A 2002 congressional inquiry found evidence that Saudi officials in the U.S. helped fund and support some of the 19 hijackers, 15 of whom were Saudis. But the pertinent 28-page section of the inquiry's final report has never been made public on the order of Presidents Bush and Obama. Congress is now considering a bipartisan bill that would allow victims' families to sue Saudi Arabia for its role in the attacks. Obama has strongly opposed the legislation, arguing that it might enable other nations to take legal action against our own diplomats. Riyadh, meanwhile, has warned that the bill would force them to suddenly sell up to $750 billion worth of Treasury securities and prevent them from being frozen by U.S. courts. This really is the mother of all cover-ups, said Paul Sperry in the New York Post. Leaks from the suppressed report reveal that when two of the 9/11 hijackers arrived in San Diego, a Saudi government official helped them find an apartment and co-sign the lease. Another handler was wired $130,000 by then-Saudi ambassador Prince Bandar. Yet the FBI was actively prohibited from investigating these links. Bandar personally met with his old family friend, President Bush, at the White House on September 13, 2001. Immediately afterward, the Bureau was ordered to help evacuate dozens of Saudi officials from multiple cities across the U.S. In its official summary of the redacted 28 pages, said George Will in the Washington Post, Congress said there was no evidence that the Saudi government as an institution or senior officials individually funded the terrorists. Those are loopholes large enough to fly a hijacked airliner through. So why do we continue to consider the Saudis allies? Asked Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Not only was Riyadh obviously complicit in 9/11, the House of Saud continues to spend billions of dollars promoting Wahhabism, a repressive fundamentalist interpretation of Islam that has inspired Islamic extremism and jihadist violence. It is time for Washington to stop running interference for the Saudis, while the Saudis run interference for the jihadists. And we'll finish with a quote from Albert Einstein. If we knew what it was we were doing, it would not be called research, would it? We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.